I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Louise Bruce. She's the Idaho High Divide Senior Specialist for the Wilderness Society. Today we're talking about the High Divide in Idaho. That's the high elevation lands in the eastern part of the state that bridges between the Yellowstone ecosystem in the east with the central Idaho wilderness to the west. Peter, this is a beautiful part of our state. High mountains, gorgeous area, also ecologically very important. We're going to dig into that.
No, this is going to be great. And I appreciate you describing what the High Divide is.
Right.
So I had to have a reminder. I'm the one who booked this. And I'm like, oh, the High Divide. Okay. Well, where's that again?
Well, exactly. And maybe other people haven't heard of that term before. And so we'll give it some context and and point to why it's particularly worth thinking about. Before we think about it, though, Peter, you've got nature in the news.
Yeah, Leif, we've got some past research that has consistently shown that swearing is linked to improved performance during physically demanding situations. Richard Stevens, the PhD, has looked into what's the psychological mechanism into how swearing helps.
Swearing?
Helps us. Swearing, yeah. Yeah.
Do you swear often?
Sure.
We're on NPR.
I know.
The kids are listening. We're and swearing.
Yeah. I don't know if we have a beeper, if we can beep things out and
we
all
can't,
that.
We so, can't beep it out. Know. So we're going to be good boys, but
yes.
Tell us more about swearing. Is it good, bad, otherwise?
Yeah, well, Richard hypothesized that by swearing, people are shifting into a more disinhibited mental state, feeling less restricted by social norms and internal hesitation, allowing them to apply more effort.
Oh, so if I swear, that puts me in a mental state where maybe I don't care as much.
Yep.
And so I'm going to, I can focus more energy into what I'm doing.
What you're doing, So what he did is he set up two experiments involving a chair push-up task with one group swearing every 2 seconds and then the second group using a neutral word every 2 seconds.
That's a great experiment.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of the movie, Kelly Clarkson. So a made up swear word. And after each group performed these exercises, they answered questions about how they felt during the exercise. Participants who swore were able to hold their body weight longer, and the performance advantage was linked to a higher level of reported psychological flow, distraction, and self-confidence, which are all key elements to a disinhibited state.
Yeah. Okay. That tracks.
Yeah.
I feel like... You know, I swear sometimes when I'm, doing some sporty thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like it helps. But it's nice to have like a study. There's
that a study
maybe
behind
is
it. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, I thought you were going to say you swear all the time. And so you're in a perpetual disinhibited state.
Depends on the day and the moment.
Depends on the day and the moment. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Well, I guess you can try this at home, swear and you can lift more sacks of potatoes or something.
Yeah. Perfect. Perfect.
When we come back from the break, we're going to answer a trivia question. Our trivia question for today is, when did the Wilderness Society originate? When we come back, Louise Bruce will join us to talk about the High Divide and what the Wilderness Society does. Stay tuned.
Did you miss the latest edition of The Nature of Idaho or ISU's Research, Innovation, and Creativity Insights? Sometimes it's tough to hear your favorite KISU shows live, but you can listen to them on demand with our free KISU mobile app for your Apple or Android device. Search your app store for KISU to get started.
Hey, welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Louise Bruce. She's the Idaho High Divide Senior Specialist for the Wilderness Society. So first off, welcome to The Nature of Idaho.
Thanks very much. It's great to be on. Your program.
Louise, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. Right now I'm based out of Salmon, Idaho, which is in the High Divide. And I've lived in the High Divide either in Idaho or in Southwest Montana for the last 40 years. And like most folks that live in these rural communities, raised kids here that hunt, fish, hike, ride bikes, motorcycles, scenic drives, the whole works. So making a transition from a variety of past jobs, including running the Outdoor Education Center for the University of Montana Western over in Dillon, to doing advocacy for wilderness areas in Montana with the Montana Wilderness Association. It was a pretty easy jump to come to work for the Wilderness Society and advocate for these really special places in the High Divide.
So can you tell us just a little bit about what the Wilderness Society does? You know, I know we've got a trivia question, and everyone will be surprised at how long your organization has been around. So talk a little bit about what they do.
Sure. So the Wilderness Society's main goal is to connect people, or our mission is to connect people with their public lands and with their wild spaces that are remaining in the United States today. And we've been at this protection of wild spaces for a very long time, a number of decades in Idaho. And throughout the history of the organization, we've always had somebody working on protection of some sort in Idaho. Most familiar probably is the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness, which is the largest designated wilderness area in the lower 48. And then also we've worked on the protections on the Middle Fork of the Salmon, and more recently in the Owyhee Canyonland. So we have a very long history of working throughout Idaho and protecting these wild spaces that are so important to all of us.
That's excellent. And is the Wilderness Society, is its coverage all of the United States?
Yeah. So we don't necessarily work in every single state, but sure, we work in most states. So if you were to visit our website, which is wilderness.org, you can go through the website and just see where we have staff people, all the issues that we work on, that staff people work on, and get a sense of how long we've been in existence and what's important to our members and our donors.
Well, let's talk about the High Divide and sure, what that term refers to, in case folks haven't heard of it or what that concept is about.
So it is an interesting term. And as you described, the word divide is in there. So follows the Continental Divide, as you mentioned, from Yellowstone. If you have an app that you look at that gives you directions, or that you use to plot your trips out into the wild country of Idaho, you can look at that and look at Find Yellowstone National Park, follow the Continental Divide all the way around to up to Lost Trail Pass in between Idaho and Montana. And so that's the high part. Well, that's one of the high parts of the High Divide. And then it stretches into Montana and into Idaho because, of course, wildlife doesn't really pay attention to administrative boundaries like we might. State boundaries, Forest Service boundaries, BLM boundaries, Bureau of Land Management boundaries, so that sort of thing. So we go all the way up to along the Continental Divide to Lost Trail Pass. And then if we drop south to Craters of the Moon National Monument, into the lava fields there. So that's a pretty big area. And then if we go farther over to the west, to the headwaters of the Salmon in the Stanley Basin. So we're looking at high mountain ranges, also sagebrush habitat, water drainages, where are the headwaters of the salmon, for instance, or the headwaters of the snake, particularly in Idaho. Just those areas that begin in these high mountain areas and then collect more water, obviously, as they go down through various forest types and into the sagebrush.
So here's the big question. Why is the High Divide so important for our conservation efforts?
Wow, that is a great question. And we look at sort of expanding development in the West, and particularly in Idaho and in Montana. And what you see from looking at Yellowstone over to the headwaters of the Salmon is a mostly intact ecosystem. You have all the components that were there before there was a westward expansion, before people started settling into homesteads, before mining, all of those things. All of the species that were there then are there now. And there are very, in spite of settlement and development and growing recreation impacts, there's still these vast expanses of land that are basically undisturbed, that are still in their wild state. So animals can travel from the Greater Yellowstone through these areas, connect with the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness Area, which then heads north into the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness Area and along the Bitterroot Ranges, and eventually connect with the greater areas that are Glacier National Park and beyond. So it's really this unique area where all these species are here and things can still travel, things can still move, people can still recreate in largely undisturbed areas.
You know, I'm going to go back to recently the new grizzly bear management plan had come out, and they were initially had multiple smaller sections for grizzly bear management and conservation. Uh-huh. And then with this new plan, they actually used the High Divide to connect the Yellowstone population out into and working towards the Frank Church Wilderness area. And so as you're describing it, I'm like, yep, that's exactly what they used, was the High Divide on their grizzly bear conservation plans.
Yeah. So when we have a science team at the Wilderness Society, and when we look at all the data layers there are, the science team looks at all the data layers, whether it's information from agencies, variety of sources of information, and you look at all of the components like fresh water, clean water, water availability, habitat intactness, climate resiliency, just whatever layers you put on it, the Idaho High Divide sits at a really important place in that whole discussion of how can species move? How can they survive? How can they thrive? Where can people recreate? Where can they live? And just all of those things that combine into these rural communities and these vast landscapes around them.
Can you describe some of the, I suppose, barriers to whether we're thinking about maybe wildlife corridors or the connectivity, I guess, between these systems as they pass through High Divide?
Sure. So roads, obviously, are a big barrier. And if we look at across the High Divide, of course, the biggest road that's there is the interstate, I-15. So, and the associated utility corridors and railroad corridor in that area. So roads are a big issue. You have the Salmon Highway coming from, you know, the Mud Lake up between the Beaverhead, Talion Peaks, Beaverheads, and the Lemhi's into Salmon. And then you have Highway 93, of course, that comes over Lost Trail, goes south and through Salmon, Chalice, and on down to Craters of the Moon. So roads, utility corridors are a barrier. Also, just development in places that animals traditionally have traveled. What we know about is there's certain animals that travel pretty specific routes, pretty specific corridors. So any sort of disruption in those corridors then will displace them. Also, you have just something as simple as fences, too. And what do fences look like? And are they keeping smaller animals in particular from moving with the rest of the herd across the landscape? I think of pronghorn in particular, who aren't known for flying leaps and jumping. They're crawl under kind of creatures. And so those are pretty big development, fences, roads. And also recently, since the pandemic, we've seen this growing dispersed recreation throughout our public lands where you have people that want to get away, they want to get out, and they just camp wherever they are allowed to. And increasing areas like that can cause disturbance or motorized use, that kind of thing. So any of that can contribute to displacement and disruption, but I would say mostly roads.
Well, I think with roads, of course, you're going to follow the natural corridors, which the animals use. And so,
For sure. So how many times have people in the High Divide, for instance, driven up 93 and over Willow Creek Summit when it's super snowy? And that's tremendous mule deer habitat. And you come up to the top of the pass, and where are the mule deer? They're walking up the road to get to the other side. So they're not jumping through huge banks of snow or anything. They're using the road too. So I would say like fatalities for both animals and probably people too, and just impact from vehicle travel too, is increasing as we have more traffic on these roads.
Yeah. So how, I guess then, knowing that these corridors exist and to some degree are fixed, the interstate is a fixed resource or a fixed corridor, and same with power lines, that sort of thing.
Right.
What are some of the approaches to maybe mitigating or reducing their barrier quality, I guess?
Wow, that's a great question, and it's a problem, right, that we all have to solve in these areas where We want to keep wildlife alive, but we also want to travel and we want to do it safely. So I think when you look across Idaho and other Western states, you see a variety of solutions. In Montana and surrounding states, Nevada even, there are wildlife overpasses that have been constructed so that wildlife can travel safely from one side of the road to the other without actually having to be on the road. And there was one of those recently completed in Idaho too, outside of Boise. So that's been pretty successful in keeping fatalities down. So we see that. We also see fences being built along, for instance, we'll say along Highway 28, Salmon Highway, between Ledor and Lemhi, in an area where there are a lot of animals crossing, a lot of collisions. And so you see these high fences that keep animals out of that road corridor. And of course, that does disrupt how they move, but it keeps the fatalities for the animals down and also for people. So those are the two main tools right now that we see.
I always wondered about the fences because you throw up a fence. What you do is you move the animals down to another area, which then makes the next dangerous wildlife crossing across the road. And so you can only put so many fences up. That's where I really appreciate whether it's a wildlife overpass or an underpass. The difficulty is they're expensive to build.
Exactly.
And in some locations, they're hard to build as well.
Exactly. Right. And they, you know, and I think that as we look at the complexity of problems that we have in rural areas, whether it's transportation, infrastructure development, all of those things, that everything's expensive. Whether you're looking at trying to replace or upgrade a municipal water system, or you're trying to make a highway safer, or you're trying to add a walking path along a highway to connect people that are pedestrian traffic, essentially, to those public lands that are close to communities. So these are just going to be continuing discussions, I'm sure.
So specific to the High Divide, what kinds of development pressures, I guess, are being felt in that region?
Well, you know, we talked about traffic already, just an increasing amount of recreational traffic. And then you have people who can work remotely now. We've seen a big surge in that after the pandemic. So you have a certain amount of increased, it's not really urban sprawl because we're not really in an urban area. So maybe we'll call it like a rural sprawl. But you have, you know, people want their own little piece of property out away from things. So you have subdivision development. You also have just repeated cycles of mineral development, mining, and just cycles of timber harvest and needing roads and infrastructure for that. So amidst all of that, then we want to keep in mind that we need to keep these places connected, like we talked about, for wildlife, and make sure we have safe passage for whether it's trucks or people, bicycles, all of that. So there's a lot of uses that we see that are competing for the same acre. And that's what makes managing public lands really challenging, is that every acre matters to somebody. And if those uses aren't compatible, then we've got to figure out a way to talk about in a civil way how we solve those problems and still retain values that are important to us.
Well, one of the values I think most Westerners feel very deeply about is the idea of public spaces. And I suppose there's always a tension between, you know, wanting to expand and maybe use up some public spaces for a new purpose, for a commercial aim or urbanization or, you know, whatever. Can you speak to that value and how the Wilderness Society connects into the desire and the value for public spaces and keeping them public?
For the Wilderness Society, the public spaces, and particularly the wild public spaces, have always been of utmost importance to protect for not only all the ecological values we've talked about, but just for the human soul and just the ability to get out and connect with the planet we all belong to, and to be able to pass those experiences on to our children and our grandchildren. So there's a multi-generational responsibility we feel for protecting those places. At the same time, there's places that are appropriate to develop things. Not every acre of public lands needs to be wilderness or should be wilderness, but at the same time, not every acre of public lands needs a road on it. So if you look at those of us who live in a rural area, we see these beautiful views and are out on these landscapes routinely and regularly. For somebody that grows up in an urban area, they may get off the plane in Idaho Falls and feel like they're in the wilderness,
right.
You know? And so, so the idea of wilderness is both one that is based on what your personal perception is of what wildness is. So, because we can talk about, well, is it big W wilderness, little W wilderness? What is wilderness? Where is it? How is it? Where do you find it? So it's been this big, both a philosophical discussion and a very practical one in terms of protecting the natural landscape that we all live in and appreciate at varying degrees. And so we will continue to look at ways to protect what's remaining of those wildlands and also work to restore wildlands that have been impacted by past episodes of development or disturbance. And that's both from a natural perspective as well as a man-made perspective. So I think looking into the future, we still want to protect these places so that we retain that freedom to go ahead and get out on public lands, regardless of our income, regardless of our background, regardless of our experience in the natural world. And also, as you mentioned, to preserve the right maybe to swear as we are planning our trips for us, right? When you were talking about that, I was thinking like, oh, was he looking at when we planned whatever backpacking trip and got into the second day and we're thinking, why in the world do we think we could climb up this with a 50-pound pack?
So, but did you do it?
We did.
Yeah, a way
we
to go swearing.
Many times.
Right.
Many times.
Yeah. Powered, fueled
yeah.
by words.
Right.
True.
When we're looking at the development of our wild spaces, do you have an advantage with the High Divide? Because it isn't really overly developed, and it's kind of difficult to develop too. So to me, I feel like you have an advantage that you're not behind the eight ball. You can kind of, because it's moving slower, you can get ready for potential development.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the reasons why for the Wilderness Society and for other organizations that work on conservation issues or more specific species issues, that this is such an important area because it isn't largely intact, and we don't have to put pieces of the puzzle back together. The puzzle's already put together.
You just have to keep it so the pieces don't get removed.
Right, right. Or whittle away, or we don't lose a piece and have to try to make one up.
I like asking this of our guests. Tell me about one of your most favorite memorable experiences in a wilderness area.
Wow. Okay.
So that involves a 50-pound pack.
Yes. Yes, it does. It does. And I think that I'm going to go back to my college days at the University of Montana.
Yeah.
And doing a through trip across the Bob Marshall Wilderness, and thinking, well, if Bob Marshall could just like walk through here, you know, and walk 50 miles a day, certainly with all his high-tech gear, and being in shape and training for this adventure, that you should be able to make it through in 3 days. So we started kind of up, if people are familiar with the Bob Marshall out on the Rocky Mountain front, out of the Shoto area and the benchmark. And so it turned into trying to be like a 3-day trip, turned into a 5-day trip. And we learned to use all kinds of creative methods to repair backpacking straps that had come loose, and just how strong is a piece of twig from a lodgepole pine in holding something together, and how far can you actually hike on just one bottle of water, and how fast can you climb a tree when a bear shows up, which is pretty fast, turns out. So,
all questions you
see,
probably really, really had an overriding desire to know.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm always an advocate for people being prepared, and also remembering that if you get yourself in, you need to get yourself out.
You would not like to hike with me because being prepared is not my strong suit. I can usually get to about 75% prepared, and after that, it's whatever.
Right. You do get to that point for sure. And you just, I think we also tend to overestimate how resilient we are in certain settings. So I would say swearing's probably important when you're planning a big backpacking trip, as well as being able to just cry once in a while. Unless, you know, you're one of those people that are in your 20s, have a day off and decide that, hey, let's just go climb Mount Borah, the highest peak in Idaho, which of course is in the High Divide and only a few hours from Idaho Falls. And we've seen this before when we've been at the trailhead of kids just driving up, basically sleeping in their car, jumping up at the crack of dawn, putting on their
Bounce up the hill.
unsock. Yep, and just bounce up the hill like it's nothing. So
Yeah,
good for them. They need to keep doing that.
on
That's
one
right.
bottle of water, too.
Yes, right. And those are the people that we need to make sure keep advocating for these areas to remain wild.
There's so much great landscape out there. We
It
can't
sure is.
encourage enough people to get out there and see it in the way that makes
Right.
sense for them. Yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes people just they want to get out in a place that's dark. Like say in the Passamaquoddy Valley where
Oh,
there's no
yeah.
lights at night and they just want to see the stars and see how big the sky really is. And it's just important to have places like that. And we have so many of those in Idaho and particularly in the High Divide.
We're really lucky. Help us with our trivia question. When did the
Sure.
Wilderness Society originate?
1935.
And who started it?
Well, one of our founders was Bob Marshall. And there was a number of other gentlemen that were also involved, and I think they all got together, the story goes, at a club in Washington, D.C., and just decided that there are wild places left that were worth protecting. So
Was it a dance
that was the
club?
genesis. I'm going to guess that there was liquor involved, but
Speakeasy.
yeah. And I think you've got the website up in front of you there that you could actually read a Bob Marshall quote.
Technology. All right.
Yeah.
Well, Louise, thank you so much for joining us today. And for those who want to read the Bob Marshall quote, please
Right.
go to the Wilderness Society's website, which is wilderness.org,
Right.
wilderness.org. So again, Louise, thank you so
Thank
much.
you.